So, welcome back on Embedded Track. Sorry for the missing talk. We hadn't any information that the speaker didn't arrive here, so he didn't even write a mail to us, so sorry about that. But now we have Hans-Jürgen Koch here from Hans-Jürgen Koch Engineering. And he has a long time history as a kernel contributor. He started kernel development in 2006 with a driver for a video for Linux RDS chip. He is the maintainer of User Space IO, and he was the maintainer of the Telechips ARM platform. So please welcome Hans-Jürgen Koch. He held a talk about avoiding mistakes in embedded systems development.
Okay, thanks, Manu. My name is Hans-Jürgen Koch, and I want to talk a little bit about embedded systems and what can go wrong with them. So what is an embedded system? That might not be clear to everybody because you normally don't really notice them in everyday life. So I've got here, I borrowed an example from the guys from Pengutronics from their booth down there. Thank you very much to them. So this is an example what could be an embedded device. Doesn't really look like a computer for most, but in fact it has many elements of a computer. In fact, it has all elements of a computer. It has a CPU, it has memory, it has the usual connections. We see here this one, what does it have? It has network, it has USB. Here we have an SD card, another USB slot, everything that you find in a normal PC, sometimes even more hardware, because some of these chips are usually connected through some buses like I2C or SPI or things like that. Where you normally don't have to deal with in normal computers. So if you do want to do development for such an embedded device, you have to, here are a few examples what an embedded device could be. For example, we have DVD players, we have navigation systems, smartphones, DSL routers or car electronics, you find them in automation, means machine control and things like that. And often you don't even notice that you have one. For example, in car electronics, there might be such an embedded device behind your dashboard and you don't even know that it is there. In your DVD player at home, users usually don't see that as a computer, it's a DVD player. And even smartphones, where you can even install apps or things like that, are usually not seen as a computer. It's a device. And but I'm very sure that each one of you here in this room has at least one embedded device in his household where he already found a bug. That something doesn't work as expected. That it suddenly crashes and it doesn't work and you have to reboot it or turn it off and on again or something like that so that it works again. Or for example, a DVD player at home and my DVD player, if I, in its menu, if I turn it on default language English, I can only watch movies in English. If I want to switch back to German or to French or something like that, it doesn't work. I first have to go to the menu and switch back to another language. So many of these devices have really serious bugs, and especially smartphones, for example, in the last few in CT magazine, they wrote articles about that. That usually each new Android version introduces new bugs or navigation systems that crash or whatever. So we and that's the surprising thing there is that usually such an embedded device is just made for one purpose. So you could think it should be easy to make that one bug free, because you don't run hundreds of applications like you do on a normal PC, but you have just one application for that does the one task, to be a navigation system or a DVD player, and it shouldn't be too difficult to get that one right. But still, it seems to be quite complicated. And the last number that I've heard is that here in Germany, at least, 80% of all new embedded systems are done with Linux. Reason for that is that we have here more and more hardware features. And 10 years ago, nobody thought about having a coffee maker or something like that that has a USB connection. Meanwhile, each TV set and has a network interface, for example, and it has to work properly, because you want to connect it to the internet. So you run in all the risks that you also have with a PC about viruses and attacks from outside. For example, you need a really, really good network stack, not just something that just makes it work. You need all the features, all the abilities of a modern desktop or server operating system. The applications also offer more and more features that you, for example, you can transfer music or video from the internet, or even executables that you execute on your device, that means you need all the abilities of a modern operating system, and that excludes all these special embedded operating systems that you had years ago, like Windows CE or things like that. And Linux, the Linux kernel especially, scales very well. We use the same kernel on embedded devices and on big servers, on supercomputers. It's in effect the same kernel, just configured differently. So if you want to have a feature that you have on your server, for example, you can easily have it on your embedded device as well. So a kernel. An embedded system, in the end, consists of course, the hardware at the bottom. You need a kernel for that. Then we need some system applications. We usually call it the root file system, where you have the standard things like a shell or the system programs like an SSH server or the different libraries you need. And then on top of that, you have your application. The application usually defines what the device will be, if it is a DVD player, or is it a navigation system, or anything else. So if somebody develops for an embedded system, it is important for him to first consider what's my company doing, what is our core competence. Often companies are mainly the application developers. Because in that application, there's the whole knowledge of that company. If somebody knows how to has developed an algorithm for machine control, that is his core competence, his special knowledge that makes him different from his competitors. If somebody has developed an algorithm for a navigation system, that's his core competence. So that company will put that in an application. And will probably maybe buy this device from another company who's specialized on, for example, hardware development. So if your core competence is application, you wouldn't go and develop your own hardware, because you don't have the specialized developers who are experienced in that area. On the other hand, there are several companies who are really specialized on hardware development and know nothing about application. I mean, that seems to be quite obvious, but what often happens is that for example, companies who write the application, they buy some hardware, but are not satisfied here with the, or don't have it, this system and kernel part. And then they tell their programmers, you're a programmer, you can do that as well. And that's usually bound to fail, because you really need special knowledge in that low-level area. And that developers usually have the special knowledge you need here. So I'm a very bad application developer. I'm coming here from, I started with hardware development and then kernel and a bit system development. Now I'm mainly doing kernel things. So I wouldn't try to write an application. And it's really important to think about that and to find out what do I want to do and what do I want to outsource. Okay, but we'll talk about that later. Okay, now we know we have an embedded system and we want to use Linux on it. Linux is open source software, also the most of the system files are also usually open source systems. So let's have a look at what open source is. That is unfortunately not very good picture of Bruce Perens. I was lucky to meet him in 2008 at the Hannover Trade Fair. He gave a good talk there about open source. He's sometimes credited by having invented the term open source. At least he was one of the very first who used it. He's also a very good programmer. He was the original author of BusyBox, for example. He gave a good talk there. And after his talk, I wanted to ask him some questions. So I went there and was, of course, very nervous and asked him if I could ask a few questions. And he said, yes, of course, but I just wanted to go to lunch. Why don't we go together? So I was lucky to have lunch with Bruce Perens, and he explained a lot of things, especially about what is open source and where can we use closed source. That is, I want to mention that because here, especially on LinuxTag, we usually favor open source, and that often leaves the impression that everything has to be open source and closed source is evil. But even Bruce Perens said you just have to decide what to do where and when and why. What he calls it differentiating features. That means on your embedded device you have a few features that really make a user visible difference between your product and the competitor's product. Hopefully, if there are no differences between your product and those of the competitors, it's probably bound to fail anyway. if you have no difference, if there's a software that makes no difference, then always use open source. That is, for example, the kernel. The kernel on an embedded device is never something that the user will see. It doesn't matter for the user which kernel you use. Most of the users don't care if it's a Linux kernel or a Windows kernel or whatever. So it really doesn't matter. So this is one element where the user sees no difference, and that's why you should use open source software like Linux. But if you have an application, and the application is usually that thing that makes the difference that's visible to the user, and that application usually contains your core knowledge, your know-how, your algorithms that you wrote, and where you think that you are better there than your competitors. And it's perfectly legal to make that closed source. That is your good right. And I think that should also be mentioned. It is important to see and to make the difference what do I have to make open source or should make open source? And then there's one application, and I will do that, I make that closed source for this and this reason. And it's important to be clear on that point. And also inform yourself about the licenses. If you want to make a closed source license for your application, you must not use, for example, GPL'd libraries. And they have to be LGPL or something, or BSD or something like that. Okay, so that is one thing that should be made clear. Many companies are not clear in this, at that point. They say, "Oh, we have to all of our source code has to be closed, or even kernel code." You know, they write a kernel driver and say, "Okay, yeah, it has to be GPL, but we cannot give it away because we paid money for it and blah blah." And then our competitors also know how we deal with our SD card or whatever. That's not the right way to do it. Okay, talking about open source software, what does open source mean? You often hear arguments like this here, it doesn't cost anything, it's more secure, it has better code, and we can change it, or things like that. That might or might not be true, depending on what we're talking about, but in my opinion, the main thing why the source is open is that people can work together on it. That was the original reason when Richard Stallman defined the GPL, was that all developers can work together on the source code, and that there's not one developer somewhere in between who can just steal the code and do something else with it. And so the term open source, in fact, describes a development process. We develop software in an open source way. And so, in fact, if we use open source software, we hopefully become part of that development process. Even if we're just a user, we still can have bug reports. Or if you walk around here on Linux Talk and you go to the booth of one project and you say, "Hey, I use that program of yours and I have that and that problem," then you're already part of the development process because you're talking directly to the programmers. That means open source means communication. You can have direct contact with programmers. You have mailing lists where you can write one mail and address a whole community of maybe a few thousand people. You have IRC channels for chat, for fast communication, where you just can ask a question and 5 seconds later somebody tells you what you're doing wrong or something like that. That is something that you never have in closed source software and cannot have in closed source software. Wherever you're dealing with closed source software, you come to a service hotline with a nice girl who reads you the manual that you already read 10 times. Okay, that means if you're in a company and developing for embedded systems, you should allow communication with the community and in fact become a bit part of the community. That is often a difficulty in companies because you don't even have a mail client with which you can post on a mailing list. If you want to send a patch or something like that, it won't work with Outlook or Lotus Notes or whatever. And often the ports usually needed for that, for example, what is IRC? 6668 or something like that. 6667, thanks. That is usually firewalled in most companies, so if you want to take a part in the IRC channel community won't work, and that's a pretty bad thing because cuts you off from the community. Let's have a look at as an example for an open source development process in the kernel. because I like to take that as an example, because the kernel is a very high quality piece of software. It has to be because it runs on every Linux device. So it has hundreds of millions of users, and a bug in there is quite a bad thing. And if you look at if you take part in the kernel development process, you notice that we're always talking about code. It's all centered around code. If we develop, we have, okay, each developer uses an editor, and we have some debug helper programs. We also do some function test, of course, but it's not the central thing. We're always talking about code. If somebody has a question, he posts code and says, why does it not work? Or if he has a suggestion, why can't we do it this way? He posts some patch as an example and says, I'd like to do it like that. Do you agree or whatever? So we are always talking about code. And if some code is written and can be accepted, then it goes through a review process. That is a very important thing. Without passing the review by the maintainers of the subsystem, it will never get into the repository in the mainline kernel tree. So that's how we do quality assurance here, by reviewing the code and by only talking about code. In contrast, that's what I just said. In industry development process, the focus is mostly on tools. Before starting to talk about code, they say, we have to develop it with this and this IDE, like Microsoft Visual Studio, or we have to use Eclipse or whatever. They're first talking about the IDE and what editor and what debugger and what version control system and blah blah, and modeling their software with UML before, and they have very much a focus on tools, and code is something that, yeah, that's somewhere in between, you know, that we don't really like to talk about it. And then in the end, they have, again, the large function test, because function test, that is something that can be defined in a quality assurance manual. They say, okay, we have to define this test case and this test case and this test case, and if the software all passes all tests, then it is good. The problem with that approach is that you can never test everything. That's pretty clear. I mean, you will never find a bug that come only once a week or so, not reproducible. Just run the test again, and then it's okay, and it's passed the test. And code review is usually never really done in industry, because it's more difficult there. On the Linux kernel mailing list, we can tell each other whatever we want. I can tell my friends there, hey, I find your code is bullshit. Or they tell me that they find my code bullshit. You cannot do that in industry. If you're sitting in a meeting in industry and say, hey, what that guy wrote, that's complete bullshit. And everybody will say, oh, how can you say that? And so you can't really criticize in an open way. That is a big problem. We have no code review. Another problem is that code goes into a repository, often in a very random way, that you have some developers, and each one has write access to the repository and can just push his stuff in. You often have large programs where there are lots of lines of code that only one person has ever seen, the one who has written them. Nobody ever reviewed them. It just happened to accidentally pass the function test, and so they say, okay, it's good, it works. And the kernel, if somebody tells me, but my code works, and I just say, I don't care if your code works. That's what I assume, otherwise you wouldn't post it. I don't want to have code that works. I want to have beautiful code. But that term beautiful code cannot really be defined in a quality assurance manual. In the kernel, we simply define it like that. Beautiful is if the maintainer says it's beautiful. It's not a democratic process, and different maintainers have different opinions about what is beautiful. But if you send a patch for the UIO subsystem, then you're really depending on what I find beautiful. If I send a patch to somebody else's subsystem, I'll get it back because he doesn't find my code beautiful. Okay, that's it. And I have to do it in the way he likes it. But this is a system that really works, and the kernel is a beautiful piece of software. Have a look at it. Okay, again, this picture here. Let's have a look at a few examples about these four pieces of, or at least at the bottom three. In hardware development, it's a good idea before you start, to check the kernel for supported chips or boards. It's often, we often have the case that somebody puts a certain chip into his board because he found a data sheet and found that's a nice chip and let's use it. But there's no support for it in the kernel, so we have to write a driver. If they look before that, they could have chosen another chip that maybe at the same price, that is already supported and saves a lot of money and has already a good and stable and tested driver. And it's often, often you get vendor support packages. You buy such a board from the hardware manufacturer, and on their homepage they have a big tarball or zip file. And where they say, that's the support for that board. There's usually an ancient kernel from 2 years ago with lots of patches on it that never made it to mainline and were never reviewed. Don't be very careful if somebody says our board is supported has Linux support. Linux support means that the device is in the mainline kernel. And anything else is not Linux support. If somebody says, you download this and download that, I really hate the word download in that context. You should never download kernel code. If it's not in mainline, which is perfectly okay, then somebody has to bring it to mainline before you ship your embedded device. Anything else is just playing around. And you should really use the offer of the kernel maintainers to review your code. They're reviewing your code for free. And I don't never understand why companies don't use that. You get the offer that of the best kernel experts, you get a free review of your code. And it's code that is not a differentiating feature for the customer. It's open source anyway. So you don't lose anything, you can just gain. They all say, I don't want it. And really, there's a barrier somehow between industry and the kernel developers, and that is one of the reasons why it often fails. Then this is also an important thing here. You shouldn't save money, try to save money, whatever the cost. In calculations, you often find that they say, I can have a smaller flash chip, and that saves me 50 cents. But then if you look at them, they're planning on selling 1,000 pieces per year or so, so they'll save 500 euros a year. But it might cause that you have to make your root file system smaller, which takes you a few weeks of engineering, and then it's certainly not worth it. Okay, we had unfortunately an example in the kernel development. You might have heard of that when Android developers worked behind closed doors for a long time and wrote some important kernel core stuff like these suspend blockers, wake locks, that now have really great difficulties because they have to maintain their code out of tree. It's a fork, and they have to maintain it. They lost the complete support of the kernel community at that point, and are now hard trying to get their stuff back to mainline. You shouldn't do that. Always use a mainline kernel. Never download kernel code. And if you're not sure on any point, ask on the mailing lists. You can get the opinion of important kernel developers for free. Use it. And that's one last point here, and that I wanted to mention. You should never ever write a raw character device driver. I mentioned that because if you start kernel development, you usually buy a book about Linux kernel driver development. And in each of these books, the first Hello World driver is some raw character device driver. That is nice, but you never need it. In 6 years of kernel development and driver development, I never wrote a raw kernel character device driver. And you don't need it. There's always a subsystem where your stuff fits in, and you should really do that. In system development, please avoid embedded distributions. That is also a thing that I frequently see. That people use think, oh, it's an embedded system. Now I have to use Open Embedded or PTX Dist. Sorry, Pangotronics guys. But it won't work, or at least it makes it more difficult. Debian now has 1,000 maintainers and 29,000 packages. No other distribution and no embedded distribution can compete with that. If you have any of these distributions, they have packages that haven't seen any maintenance in 1 year or 2 years or so. And you frequently run into the situation where you have, okay, I see my time is over, I've got to be a bit faster. That one package is missing, and then you have to start compiling your package yourself. So please use a large distribution like Debian. You can get a Debian system in 100 megabytes. Not with a standard installer, but you have to help it a bit, but you can have your root file system within a few days. And with an embedded distribution, you'll certainly need weeks. And what comes out is worse. So you should never compile your own root file system unless you have a really very special occasion where it has to fit into 4 megabytes of flash or so. But now we are in the gigabyte flash times, and you don't actually need it. And another thing for your own application, never cross compile it. If you're working for ARM, for example. Do not cross-compile, make a virtual machine with using QEMU or something like that, and compile it natively in a virtual machine. Okay, that's some conclusions. For these parts for anything, you should always try to hire good programmers. If application is your stuff, then hire good application programmers. If you need to do something else that is not within your core competence, then outsource it. You should never outsource core competence, but you should outsource those things that are not your core competence. Go to some, for example, if you need to do kernel development and you cannot do it yourself, consider hiring some consultant. There are some companies and freelancers available who do that. Me, for example, or Linotronics or Pangotronics, and many others. And Otherwise, in open source software, try to become part of the community, participate in mailing lists, talk to the people, discuss your problems on the IRC channels, try to make your code quality as important as your, as just the function tests, and so make code review a standard procedure in your development process, and try to stick to standards. Avoid unofficial code, but don't use some embedded distributions, some vendor kernels, some vendor drivers. Don't write your own algorithms if they're available in free libraries and so on. Use brains, not tools. That's, I think, the conclusion. Okay. So any questions?
Thank you very much for your talk, Hans-Jürgen. And for the real good conclusion. So are there any questions? I think we are over time, but we can allow one or two. Yes.
Well, what do you think about Arduino and the whole hype around it, the development, the Arduino boards, the small embedded boards?
I didn't actually use them personally, but I think it's quite nice. I mean, you find several small boards at low prices, and it's certainly a good thing. I mean, if they support what you need, then feel free to use it. I'm really glad that it developed a bit in that way. That for example. Texas Instruments or Atmel, that they offer boards at quite low prices, or Marvell. I mean, after one started offering his $49 board or $99 board, the others had to do it a bit too, you know. And I find it good. And I mean, if you always have to have a look if it has the features that you need for your project. If it has the features, then please do feel free to do so.
Okay, one more question. Oh, I try to bring you the microphone.
Why are you so critical about cross-compiling?
Because most many packages are not made for it. There are some that really cross-compile very fine. For example, I was able to cross-compile a complete GTK, glib system within a few hours or one day or something like that, but other packages, you really can spend days and weeks until you fix the makefile so that it compiles correctly. The main problem is if it has a configure make install using the auto tools, the configure script. Sometimes generates a little piece of C code and wants to compile it to make certain tests. And it often confuses the host compiler with the cross compiler. So it uses, for example, if it uses the cross compiler to make the test and then tries to run the compiled code on the host, it won't work. It tries to execute ARM code on x86 and fails there. Means your configure script fails, and you can really spend hours until you have fixed that. Yes, but of course it is, but that doesn't help you if you just want to compile all the packages. No, I'm not talking about Debian code. Debian code. That is a different thing because Debian never cross-compiles. They always do it in natively. The main reason if you cross-compile is, for example, your own application. I mean, if you mess that up, it's your own problem. But if, for example, if somebody downloads an X server or something like that, and because he wants to compile it to enable certain features or disable others to make it smaller or something like that. Then I would compile it natively now and not doing cross-compiling. It's just a hint. It's my personal experience. If somebody likes to do cross compiling and it's okay, then feel free to do so. I just, in my from my experience, I did it for several years. I compiled complete root file systems by cross compiling, and I don't want to do it anymore. It's as simple as that.
Okay, so thank you, Hans-Jürgen, for your talk and questions. I'm sure if you have any more questions to Hans-Jürgen, he is present here around or outside, and you can ask him. But we are just a little bit in a hurry now. So please thank Hans-Jürgen Koch for this excellent talk.
Okay. I thank you for your attention. Thanks for listening.